Hi, I'm Ben Trefney, KALW's news director, asking for your support in KALW's spring membership campaign. Go to KALW.org and click Donate Now. We appreciate it.
KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Sunset.
University Park North.
Glen Park.
Lake Merritt.
The West Portal neighborhood.
Nopa.
Cupertino.
Hayward, California.
Fairfield.
Coming up, how the Bay Area won the title of worst roads in the country.
It needed to be fixed 10 years ago. It needed to be fixed 10 years before that. But now it's just gotten to the place where it all got old at one time.
Then how a concert series is connecting musicians across genres.
It almost feels like a musician summer camp.
And we find out why volunteers at San Quentin Prison do what they do.
If they've learned no job skills or no emotional skills, then how do you want to meet these guys next? Coming through your kitchen window?
The latest from San Quentin Radio and more on this special extended version of Cross Currents. All the rain we got here in the Bay Area this past winter opened up new potholes and washed away chunks of our streets. The weather exposed a chronic problem here, poorly maintained roads. For 2 years in a row, a study funded by the transportation industry found that the Bay Area has the worst roads in the nation. We sent KALW's transportation reporter Eli Wertschafter to find out why.
We're going underneath 80 right now. All the rumbling you're hearing is just a series of potholes.
Kat Spediacci has lived in the city of Richmond almost her whole life, and she's giving me a kind of neighborhood tour of crumbling roads.
You just can hear the car bounce. This is all because of the roads around here. Patch, 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 patch.
She drives me out to an intersection near her house. There's a steep hill, and where it bottoms out, a gaping pothole. Collecting water.
And it's only going to get worse. Every time a car hits it, it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
There are rough gashes all around the pothole, like a giant mountain lion has been clawing at the pavement.
All these ridges are from cars hitting it too fast and scraping and cutting into the pavement.
Spediacci works in an auto repair shop nearby, so she's seen it all. And she says her customers are constantly coming in with busted tires after they hit potholes. It's happened to her, too.
I hit it and I felt it all the way through my car. I felt it in my steering wheel.
She says she's actually lost 3 wheels this way, and it costs hundreds of dollars each time.
No one should have to spend that sort of money on repairing their cars for bad road damage.
The 2016 Worst Roads Report estimated that Bay Area drivers pay almost $1,000 a year in extra maintenance and fuel costs, just because of our rough pavement. Spediacci points out that the Bay Area has a lot of money and nice weather. It kind of doesn't make sense why we've ended up with the worst roads in the country.
Especially if we are paying our taxes, paying our registration fees on time, paying for all the road repair, paying our gas tax. Why are our roads in such poor condition?
That's the big question. To find out, I go over to a slick, modern building in downtown San Francisco, the headquarters of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. That's the agency that coordinates transportation plans for the Bay Area. And I asked their spokesman, Randy Rentschler, why the roads here are so dismal. And he doesn't want to just pick on the Bay.
Look, roads are crappy all over the nation, okay? I mean, if you want to go to see some crappy roads, go to Detroit. They have some crappy roads, too.
Okay, fine. But Detroit actually has the fourth worst roads in the country, according to the study. The South Bay is number 3, and the San Francisco-Oakland area is number 1. The worst roads. Why? Well, to start with, Rentschler says that maintaining roads here is especially expensive. Our roads are very heavily used, which means they get a lot of wear and tear. It's also expensive to shut them down.
If you ask Caltrans to do the work at night, which they do to try to get out of the way of the cars, it makes the cost go way up.
And then there's the high wages in the Bay Area. Add that to a State Department of Transportation that spends more proportionately on overhead costs than almost any other state. Fixing roads here is expensive. And then, Rentschler says, there's another factor. It has to do with the history of the Bay Area. He points out that so much of it was built after the Second World War.
We in the Bay Area are huge beneficiaries every day of this sense of urgency that our parents and grandparents had that came before us.
They literally paved the way for us. But Rentschler says that generations since then haven't done enough to maintain what they built. And the longer you put off road maintenance, the more it costs.
needed to be fixed 10 years ago, needed to be fixed 10 years before that. But now it's just gotten to the place where it all got old at one time.
In California, we rely on the state gas tax as the single biggest source of paving dollars. But since the 1960s, lawmakers have only raised the tax a few times, and only by pennies per gallon.
People would not raise the gas tax. People would not prioritize repair because you could just postpone it for another year.
So while the cost of road repair has climbed higher and higher, the state gas tax hasn't kept pace. The state used to finance the lion's share of road maintenance, but last year, local governments paid for 50% and the state covered just over 40%, with the feds picking up the rest.
Other states have a much bigger state role in transportation.
This is Ratna Amin. She's the transportation director for SPUR, an urban planning think tank in the Bay Area.
We raise a lot of our revenue locally. This is not common across the country. It's becoming more and more common in California, however.
That explains all those transportation sales taxes you see on your local ballot. And it means that, especially in the Bay Area, boring old street maintenance has to compete with other things that voters want, like new bridges, new BART stations. Amin says there's just never enough money for every single thing we need.
In the Bay Area, we could choose to raise money only for pavement maintenance, never expand our transit system, don't add buses, and we would probably have perfect pavement. But that's not the reality we live in.
No. In our reality, we have very imperfect pavement. And drivers pay the price at the repair shop.
This is the wall of shame.
I'm at Dana Meyer Auto Care in Albany, the shop where Kat Spediacci works. She shows me a collection of their favorite busted car parts.
Parts that have catastrophically failed, parts that have broken in ways we don't normally see.
You hit a pothole and your wheel bearing could end up here, on the wall of shame. Spediacci says drivers are getting angry.
Now California in general is screaming that we want our infrastructure replaced, but we don't want to pay for it.
Just last month, Governor Brown signed a $52 billion plan to pay for infrastructure. Most of that money funds road repairs. It's paid for by increased user fees and a hike in the gas tax, the first one in almost 20 years. Spediacci supports the deal.
It's kind of like insurance. Pay a little bit now. Avoid the big bill later.
Drivers will pay more at the gas station. But with better roads, hopefully they'll spend less at the repair shop. In Albany, I'm Eli Wirtschafter for Cross Currents.
If you have a transportation story you want Eli to investigate, send him an email at transportation@kalw.org. Coming up, how a concert series gets people grooving to music they might not even have heard of.
They never thought they'd be into hip hop. And the favorite moments of mine are like at the Freight and Salvage when we present an electronic act and all of a sudden a silver-haired lady gets up out of her chair and starts dancing. And for me, those are the things that make me do what I do.
Welcome back to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The Bay Area is a music lover's paradise. Any night of the week, you can go out and hear jazz, hip-hop, Afrobeat, Indonesian gamelan, Western chamber music, or whatever your heart and ears desire. But despite that diversity, sometimes musicians themselves can feel siloed in their own genres. The project Undercover Presents aims to bring the Bay Area's musical communities together on one stage. KALW's Jen Sheehan tells us more.
Undercover Presents is a concert series that brings together Bay Area bands and musicians to reinterpret a classic album with a different musical act doing each song. The next one will celebrate the 50th anniversary of the iconic Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band!
Yeah.
An orientation of sorts is taking place at the recently renovated UC Theater in Berkeley. A couple dozen musicians and producers have just tromped around on a tour to get familiar with where they'll be performing. And now, more importantly, they're meeting each other over beer and pupusas.
It almost feels like when you get in the swing of it, almost like a musician summer camp.
Kevin McCann plays keyboards in the San Francisco indie rock band Eyes on the Shore. He's actually played in an undercover show before, but with a different band.
There's so many people, you're running around, and you're making new friends and making all kinds of crazy connections that you wouldn't normally have made. You know, people in pretty diverse genres of music that you're not necessarily going to be on the same bill ever. And all of a sudden, we're all thrown in the same room, on the same stage, doing the same thing. It's pretty incredible.
These shows have happened for 7 years now, with a diverse range of source material. The series has included tributes to funk legends Sly and the Family Stone, punk heroes Green Day, British folky Nick Drake, and Icelandic genre tripper Björk.
Think you're denying me or something? Well, I got plenty.
Every show has a different guest music director who helps curate the bands and guide the sound of the show. For Sgt. Pepper's, it's Joe Begale. After the meet and greet, he addresses the musicians.
Oh, I'm just so happy that you guys are all here. The Beatles is like my number one, and the reason that all of y'all are here is because you represent the badassery that we have here in the Bay Area. And I think we all share a common bond in terms of how that band has inspired us and informed us.
The idea for Undercover Presents was dreamed up by Liz Luke and Cherith Primawardana. After a night of brainstorming, they landed on a concert featuring the Velvet Underground and Nico album. The very next day, they started making phone calls. Within a month, they had put together a lineup. The Bay Area was a buzz. Well-known musicians were asking if they could join. They added a second show when the first one sold out.
And what costume shall the poor girl wear? To all tomorrow's party.
The concert was a roaring success. Liz Luke thought it would be a one-off.
But after the first night, I definitely saw that. I saw the chemistry that was happening between the musicians and in the audience. I saw musicians getting huge really fast after this gig and being given opportunities that they normally wouldn't be able to get.
Now, Luke has executive produced 14 Undercover Presents shows. She takes care of all the behind-the-scenes stuff, like booking, promoting, and holding the vision of the project. She's not a musician herself, but says she's Undercover's executive music enabler.
Musicians started recording on albums together. They started sharing concert bills together. They started just inviting each other out socially. And for the audience, it became really special because there were people who've never listened to Afrobeat music. They never thought they'd be into hip-hop. And the favorite moments of mine are like at the Freedom Salvage when we present an electronic act and all of a sudden a silver-haired lady gets up out of her chair and starts dancing. And for me, those are the things that make me do what I do.
She says it's important to her to keep the lineups fresh, to invite new musicians into the project every time. This is to keep increasing the breadth of the community, but she also says she wants everyone in the audience to be able to relate to someone on stage at some point in the show.
And so that can mean a lot of things. That could mean cultural backgrounds, that could mean age, it could mean body type, it could mean sexual orientation, it could mean ability. And we are incredibly thoughtful when looking at the roster to make sure we aren't skewing too much one way or the other.
The musicians in the Sgt. Pepper's show are from genres ranging from soul to jazz to pretty much anything you can imagine. That's Rohan Krishnamurthy. He's a classical Indian trained percussionist who's also studied jazz, Western classical, and pop music. He's going to cover Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite with saxophonist Prasant Radhakrishnan and keyboardist Colin Hogan.
There will be a show tonight on trampoline. The Hendersons will all be there in a pound of magazines.
Krishnamurthy says he sees the Undercover Project as a way to bridge cultural and geographic divides in the music world.
Here in the Bay, you know, there's actually, the Bay has one of the largest Indian diasporas in the country, but the Indian arts scene is actually quite sort of separated from a lot of other arts scenes.
He's excited to pay tribute to a band that helped pave the way for his own musical blend of Indian and Western influences.
Of course, you know, a lot of people know that the Beatles were heavily influenced by Indian music and Indian spirituality. Within You and Without You is kind of this piece in the album that's heavily influenced by Indian music in a very obvious way. There's sitar, there's tabla. But we thought this would be an interesting kind of challenge. What if we took a different piece like Mr. Kite, which, you know, is has all these sort of circus kind of, you know, effects and elements, and what if we brought this kind of Indian classical and contemporary jazz, you know, perspectives to it?
Singer-songwriter Kendra McKinley says it's this chance to celebrate her musical heroes that she's most excited about. She's covering Lovely Rita.
I listened to them exclusively until I was 12 years old. To me, they were music, and everything else was extra. For me personally, it's so much more about celebrating this band and what they've provided for people rather than it being an opportunity to, you know, showcase the individuals.
My favorite part is standing backstage, watching the musicians, watching the other musicians, and it's incredibly, incredibly special.
Music enabler Liz Luke has been bringing artists together with Undercover for 7 years now. She's hoping for at least seven more. And she can do it with a little help from her friends. In Berkeley, I'm Jen Sheehan for Cross Currents.
Undercover's Sergeant Pepper's show is happening next month on June 2nd and 3rd at the UC Theater in Berkeley. Find all that information at klw.org and click Cross Currents. Next, we're going to tag along with volunteers inside California's oldest correctional institution.
The first thing that stood out for me was the instant realization that it wasn't scary. And that was surprising. And walking in through the count gate at San Quentin into this yard with flowers growing, the sort of peaceful nature of the setting surprised the hell out of me.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Now it's time for San Quentin Radio.
San Quentin Radio, bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden you heard this.
San Quentin, the historic prison on the edge of San Francisco Bay, confines about 3,800 inmates. 726 of those men are condemned to death row. But there's also the correctional officers, medical staff, cooks, chaplains, counselors, and a very unique group of people, volunteers. Each month, thousands of volunteers come inside the prison to help run more than 70 rehabilitative programs there. San Quentin Radio's Tommy Shakur Ross has this story.
Every day, thousands of commuters drive past the infamous San Quentin. Many of them, perhaps, have their own ideals or assumptions about what's in here. A tour of San Quentin would reveal 5-tier housing units, high walls surrounded by gun towers and areas fenced off with razor wire. You'd enter the prison yard with a track, pull-up bars, a tennis and basketball court, San Quentin's baseball field of dreams, and a view of Mount Tam looming in the background. On average, 3,000 volunteers come into San Quentin every month.
So my name is Karina Montag, and I co-facilitate Vogue in San Quentin, which is the Victim Offender Education Group.
My name is Steve McNamara. I work with San Quentin News.
My name is Sandy Clare. I have volunteered in the GED Study Hall, the PUP Writing Study Hall, Restorative Justice, and now in the Media Center.
Clare and McNamara had a similar experience the first time they walked San Quentin's yard.
The first thing that stood out for me was the instant realization that it wasn't scary, and that was surprising. And walking in through the count gate at San Quentin into this yard with flowers growing, the sort of peaceful nature of the setting surprised the hell out of me.
You go through different inspections, you go through a sally port, you hear the loud gates close, but then you go out onto this beautiful upper patio with beautiful rose bushes that, by the way, have incredible smells that are wonderful. And then you go down the hill and there's the yard, and that's a little intimidating at first. But I think what changes is the people that kind of call out hello or say thanks for coming in. And I think from the beginning you feel appreciated.
But Montag's experience was quite different.
I mean, there was grief. Yes, there was a pull. You know, there is a feeling of coming onto the yard that this is where all of the black and brown men are. And as a black woman, that was something that, again, intellectually, we know the statistics. Visually, it was something very different to see. There was a real, a sinking feeling.
For a lot of the men inside, it's almost the opposite. It's exciting when volunteers come in. There's all kind of programs that volunteers function in. For example, McNamara volunteers with San Quentin News, which not only includes helping a select group of prisoners put out a print newspaper, but also escorting guests in and out of the prison to attend periodic forums that the newsroom runs. On one occasion, he says he walked in top District Attorney George Gascon for that purpose.
One of the things that you will see coming from our office is a real commitment to re-engineering the criminal justice system.
There's him, and there's some other assistant DAs, and then there are about 15 or 20 inmates, and we sit in a big circle, and these guys go around and talk. First thing they say is what they're in for, and then they talk about their background, what got them here, and how this experience has changed them, and what they hope to do when they get out.
Vogue gave me an education I would never had. I got my AA in prison. I'm the only one among my siblings that graduated from college. Prison did this for me.
Karina Montag remembers how I felt the first day she came inside for a victim offender education group, or Vogue, training circle.
I guess I was a little bit nervous, but I was more nervous about sitting in and being an observer while some of the men in the circle shared their stories, because the stories are really intimate and really personal.
But now she comes in on a weekly basis. In fact, Montag has become the program director and clinical supervisor for the Insight Prison Project, which is an umbrella for a number of self-help programs at San Quentin, including Vogue.
Vogue is, I think in a nutshell, it's about the men in the group taking accountability for their crimes and gaining insight into what led up to committing their crimes.
Volunteer Sandy Clare has provided educational tutoring and study hall for the Prison University Project. She says it's a mutually rewarding experience for her and the prisoners that she tutors.
you're working with a lot of the same people consistently, and you watch them grow. You watch their writing get better. You watch their thought process and their organizational skills get better, and it's really, really rewarding. And they have different perspectives, and everything challenges you, and they kind of enhances your own thinking. So, did they give you some prompts? What do you?
Yeah,
do you have any history books?
I'm kind of
no.
stuck.
Can you come back about an hour and working with somebody?
I always
right
get stuck. Okay.
Claire, who is 66, and McNamara, who's 82, are both white. Montag, who's 42, is black. They represent a small portion and demographic of the volunteers at San Quentin. Each of them have their own reasons for volunteering. Montag, for example, has been coming into San Quentin for about 2 years, and she believes that everyone deserves to be witnessed and seen.
Everybody has a story worth hearing and worth sharing, and through expressing that story and having it be witnessed, there's so much that can be learned.
McNamara has been volunteering for over 8 years. He says it's longer than he went to Princeton. He's motivated to help change the frame of mind which led the men to prison in the first place.
If they've learned no job skills or no sort of emotional skills than they had before they got in, then how do you want to meet these guys next? Coming through your kitchen window? So the idea that somebody might be steered in another direction and that you can have a hand in that process is to me not only ethically compelling, but very practical.
And Claire's been helping out for 5 years now. She's motivated by social justice and humanitarian aspects.
I can't imagine dumping somebody out in the street after not having interacted with people, some women or you know, different types of people. It just is kind of brutal. It is brutal.
The transition doesn't have to be brutal. Montag thinks men can learn different skills inside San Quentin that they can take beyond the walls when they leave.
I mean, the facilitation skills could be applied like specifically to counseling, teaching, you know, anything where you're interacting with people, where you're managing people in a position of leadership.
McNamara and Claire are equally optimistic about how the programs can help men re-enter society.
The former layout editor here, Richard Lindsay, has got a very high-powered job working with a company, actually being a leader of a company that does installation of high-end electronics in million-dollar houses.
One person who was released after the Three Strikes initiative passed, Prop 36, has gone on, just completed a BA degree and is entering a master's program.
The volunteers and the programs that they are a part of not only has a positive influence on the men in San Quentin, they also challenge negative ideals and assumptions that others may have about San Quentin and many of the men inside.
I thought it was interesting because when I told one of my girlfriends that I was volunteering here, she said, oh, San Quentin, she said, I hate driving by there. It's like this black hole and just this bad place. And I said, no, it's really not. There's some wonderful things happening there. And an hour later, she called me back and she said, thank you. She said, I'm not going to think about it in the same way anymore. And I thought, wow, right on, you know, right on.
The volunteers of San Quentin, changing negative ideals and assumptions on both sides of the prison wall. I'm Thomas Shakur Ross with San Quentin Radio. I'm out.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time to dig into the work you don't think about and the people who do it. Today, we're headed to the salon, but this one doesn't offer a cut and color. It's where you go to get rid of tiny creatures that no one wants crawling around in their hair. Casey Miner decided to spend a morning with the people behind the combs in this episode of the podcast, The Specialist.
Sophia DeLuce and Pam Fukui's salon feels private. From 10 in the morning, sometimes long into the night, they and their staff comb hair. Long, short, curly, straight, dyed black, dyed blue. And if you listen very carefully and get in very close, which you have to do for this job, you will always hear this sound. They comb a section of hair, then wipe the comb on a white towel. It's a kind of meditation. Comb, wipe, comb, wipe.
What we do with the white towel is we wipe the bugs on it.
I'm Casey Miner, and this is The Specialist. Wipe, comb, 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 wipe.
We're kind of incognito. You know, a lot of people are very uncomfortable with the whole situation of having lice.
Lice.
My name is Sophia DeLuce. I am the co-owner of Comb It Out Lice Removal.
And my name is Pamela Fukui. I am also the co-owner. I get in there, comb lice.
People have combed lice out of their hair for a long time. But as far as I can tell, lice combing salons are a relatively new kind of business. News stories about them start popping up around 2007. Today, if you can afford it, you have your choice of close to 36 in the Bay Area alone. Most try to ease the embarrassment with cute names. There's Knit Pixies, Catcher's Knits, Hair Bears, and yes, Comb It Out.
Okay, so tour. Okay, so obviously when you walk in...
The Comb It Out Lice Removal Salon is in a strip mall in Concord, California. It shares a parking lot with a Starbucks, a tanning salon, and an indoor mini golf course. The logo on the window is a pert-looking pink and black comb next to a sign that says open. And the white window shades are always drawn.
People can't see in, they can't look in, and you know, ho, I know that family.
Inside, the salon looks like, well, a salon. There's black leather swivel chairs next to stands with clean white towels and combs. But there aren't any mirrors on the walls. You don't really need to see what's going on. Of course, I kind of want to.
What do they look like on the towel when it's covered with lace?
I can look and see if we have one.
Now's when you probably want to finish up that meal you're eating, maybe stop brushing your hair, but keep listening. I promise, it's not that bad, and this is information you can use. Okay, ready? Here are the facts. Head lice are little bugs that drink your blood and lay eggs in your hair. Your clean hair, by the way. They aren't dangerous, but they do spread. They're most common in kids. Kids are always touching each other's heads by running around and playing, sharing hats and brushes, having sleepovers, things like that. It used to be that if you had lice, you had to stay out of school until they were all gone. But some schools are changing that policy because lice don't carry disease. They won't make you sick, they just make you itch. Once one kid gets it, more kids can get it. And their parents, their friends, grandparents, nannies, you get the idea. Cases are not always obvious.
If you've never seen it before,
how do you know?
You have no idea what you're looking for. An egg doesn't look like anything, looks like a piece of dandruff.
So back to our demonstration. It's still early, around 10 a.m. on a Tuesday morning, before any clients arrive. So Sophia heads for one of the garbage bins near the chairs and pulls out just what I've been waiting to see, a used white towel.
So this is a bad case right here.
All right, well, it's a little less white now.
It kind of looks
pepper?
Like pepper.
Like somebody sprinkled pepper.
The specialist, not for the squeamish.
We would say that they've had lice, I'd say about 3 months. That's a good amount.
Before they came in.
Yes, yeah. And a lot of them have done something at home, so we really don't know how bad it actually was. Yeah, that's a good 2-hour combing for us, and they probably have to come in about 3 times to totally be cleared.
Sophia and Pam say this is one of the reasons people come to them. Combing is tedious, it's time-consuming, and it's hard to be sure if you got all the lice. You can buy over-the-counter treatments, but they don't always work. A recent study even suggested that lice are evolving to resist the chemicals. And even if you do use a treatment, you still need to comb as a follow-up, to pull bugs and eggs off the hair, strand by strand.
But this does not stop people from trying a whole lot of home remedies before they come to the salon.
When I was a child, my mom used Raid.
Raid, like for ants. This is Comb It Out staffer Alexandra Guzman, by the way. They're a full-time comber.
Someone tell us, like, beer, gasoline, and put out in the hot sun.
Kerosene. We've heard it all. Lysol. Listerine.
Yes, Listerine. Mayonnaise.
Coconut oil.
Vinegar.
Olive oil.
Lime
anything
juice.
That's in your kitchen cabinet, I guess, yeah. They've tried to put.
Just soaking your hair in lime juice as well. I'm like, must have smelled great.
That's such a range. Like, I'm just imagining the person who's like, kerosene. Oh, that didn't work. Okay, mayonnaise. Like, you know, I mean, like, that's such a, like, what is it? Do you guys know where that's, any of that comes from?
Okay. Internet.
Internet.
The internet. The world's most general specialist.
Kerosene is supposed to kill it. Mayonnaise is supposed to smother it. Oil is supposed to smother it. Listerine's supposed to kill it.
They'll put like the whole jar of mayonnaise on their head and get a plastic bag tied up and go to sleep all night like that, and then get up and rinse it out. If they still see an egg, repeat the process. And you know, they'll keep their kids out of school for like 2 weeks trying all these home remedies.
And do they work?
No.
This is why we know of them, because they don't work, because they land up here. Like, I've tried everything.
A treatment costs $85 an hour, plus another 20 or so for each additional 15 minutes. And remember, treatments take about 2 hours, and you'll probably need to come back at least once. In the meantime, they send you home with a list of follow-ups. Wear hair up, wash anything that touched someone's head, put things like stuffed animals in plastic bags for a few weeks. And if you're not sure what you're looking for, they keep a handy guide at the front desk. Dead nits, nymphs, and full-grown lice taped to a card so you can look and compare them to whatever's in your hair.
So they could touch it and they're not icked out.
Sophia and Pam are not icked out. They're both in their 30s, they both have kids. Sophia got into lice combing first, kind of randomly, when someone offered her a gig while she was trying to escape a dead-end security job. She and Pam have been friends since high school, and they talked about what she was doing. At that point, Pam was about to be laid off too. So once Sophia learned the trade, she taught Pam how to comb, and they went out on their own.
Were you always this? Like, how did you get to a place where you're just like, oh yeah, see that one, and pull this one over here?
Honestly though, sometimes when we get bad cases, we do freak out.
Yeah, I was afraid they were crawling up my hand, you know, up my shoulder, onto my hair. But after, you know, I learned they don't jump, they don't fly. I'm not hugging every client, putting my head together. I wear my hair up in a bun, tight bun, and we de-lint.
De-lint. They have those little Scotch tape lint rollers everywhere.
That's a very important factor if you don't do that. You know, when you're combing, there, some of them, like, you know, come off when you comb and they get on your shirt. And so you have to de-lint because you'll pull your shirt over your head and wham.
Can you do a dry check first? I'm like all itchy and just, it's my head, you know.
Okay.
In the afternoon, a stressed out mom arrives. Her kids have had lice and now she needs to get checked. She asked me not to use her name, not even her first name. Remember about the drawn window shades?
I was completely freaking out. I couldn't sleep. I'm up at 3 a.m. online, leaving messages for people.
Sophia and Pam say this happens a lot, by the way. They come in the morning and their voicemail is full of panicked messages. And unfortunately, they are not always problems they can solve.
We have to sometimes stop people from bringing things into us. Like, it doesn't look like lice. Can I bring it in? Mm-mm. Because it freaks us out thinking that somebody's going to bring a bed bug in here and thinking it's a lice. Like, oh, God. And we've combed out fruit flies out of people's hair before. Like, okay, that's a fruit fly.
You're lice free, but you've got fruit flies.
Now that's a problem.
That piece was sound designed by Seth Samuel, who also wrote all the music. You can hear more episodes of The Specialist on iTunes and Stitcher, or right on our website, klw.org. Coming up, our Hey Area project investigates one of your questions. Why doesn't the fountain in Justin Herman Plaza ever have water in it?
Only one time did I see it at its full capacity, and I thought, huh, that's the point of that sculpture.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Hey Area is a project where we find answers to questions you ask. Ingrid Roseborough from San Francisco wants to know why the huge fountain in the Embarcadero has no water in it.
I've just noticed in the 5 years that I've lived there that it's very rarely or never on.
KLW's Jürgen Klemm dove right in.
Erected in 1971, the 40-foot-high concrete fountain consists of huge, square tubes capable of shooting out 30,000 gallons of water in a minute. Designed by Armand Villancourt, it looks rough, robust, unfinished and powerful. Some like it, others don't. Electricity or aesthetics, the waters have been turned on and off for various reasons. But in 2014, the drought was declared a state of emergency and all of the city's fountains were turned off.
I figured that might be it, but I just wondered maybe since the drought was coming to an end, if they plan to maybe show it more or, you know, have a weekend that the public could kind of view it at its full capacity.
The San Francisco Arts Commission believes the fountain succeeds as a work of art if it provokes dialogue and discussion. Well, now the dialogue and discussion is about money. The city's Recreation and Parks Department says the fountain needs almost $500,000 of work, but they don't have this kind of money in their budget. For Hey Area in San Francisco, I'm Jürgen Klemm.
If you have a question you want to ask our Hey Area project, go to our website, klw.org. We're bringing you stories you're interested in about the places where you live, and we feel strongly about that.